This month, you likely saw headlines about tech billionaires Susan and Michael Dell donating $6.25 billion to a new U.S. initiative to create savings accounts for children. These are called Trump accounts. This is a truly massive philanthropic gift. Very few billionaires write multi-billion dollar checks. And it's also for a very unique policy approach, creating these savings accounts for children early in their life that they can access as adults. GiveDirectly runs a number of programs in the U.S. focused on giving cash to new parents and to young adults. While these programs are exclusively funded by donors who specifically give to our U.S. work, we thought everyone would be interested in learning more about this big policy and what the evidence in the U.S. says about cash for this time of life. So for today's episode, we're airing a recording of a panel discussion hosted by Jeremy Ney of American Inequality, featuring GiveDirectly U.S. Country Director Dustin Palmer and policy analyst and writer Leah Labresco-Sargent. Here's that conversation.
So Dustin, Leah, thanks so much for joining today.
Thanks for having us.
Leah, I want to start off by asking you a question, right? So in this time of deep, political polarization, where there's a lot of uncertainty around family policy, you have written a lot around, baby bonds versus baby bonuses. Can you just lay the foundation about why we are seeing this at this point in time, the type of impact we think it's going to make, and your understanding of how this policy is going to roll out?
Absolutely. No, I think one positive thing we're seeing about interest in both baby bonds and baby bonuses is that these are family benefits programs that are rooted in a fundamental trust of parents. These aren't kind of incredibly prescriptive programs like which exact food should be able to buy on SNAP. They're, programs that kind of take for granted that parents with young kids are trying to do their best for their kids. And we've really seen that borne out through some of the studies of CTC expansion and seeing what parents chose to spend money on, that it's food and supplies for kids. It's not cigarettes and booze or whatever else you might imagine. So we know this money tends to go where we want it to go without burdening parents with additional restrictions. But when you contrast a baby bonus, which is money paid out directly to parents after a baby is born, cash in hand, to baby bonds, which are essentially what the Trump accounts and the Dell Plus Up are, which is money that's put in an investment account that kids get access to either when they turn 18 or with some other nuances to how and when they can claim the money, they're clearly trying to solve different problems. Baby bonds have been cited for being a response both to how to set kids out with a bit more of a nest egg as they start their adult life, prepare them for college, marriage, et cetera, and how to give them an emotional investment in capitalism, I think is how Ted Cruz framed it, where because you'll own these index funds, you have both an exposure and an investment in the total stock market. Baby bonuses, in contrast, are about helping parents get over the income shock that comes in that first year. Parents tend to lose about 10% of their income when a baby is born, partly through leave or other disruptions. And you can think of a baby bonus as essentially functioning like unemployment insurance. It smooths your income during this period of turbulence, during a period where we really want you to be able to make both the choice for the baby and to be able to make the next right choice for that child.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And I think so many people undervalue, how impactful, right, that can be, and so often we think about you got to start saving for your kids' college, from the moment that they're born and be ready for when they turn 18 without realizing that those first few years of life can be so incredibly expensive. And I think in 34 states, it is more, expensive to send your kid, through 4 years of childcare than it is through 4 years. of college. Those beginning years trying to make sure people have funds for that can be so important. But Dustin, when you heard this announcement, right, and so much of the direct cash giving work that you do, what were your thoughts about this? As you were thinking about it, Leah had alluded to some of them already of the CTC, the child tax credits, the EITC, the earned income tax credit. Did you think about this $6.25 billion and those same, types of ways of amazing direct cash program, or was it different in your eyes?
Yeah, appreciate that. I think it's an unqualified excitement across GiveDirectly when we saw this announcement. I mean, getting money directly to babies, to children, to future children, I think there's no way not to celebrate that as an act of generosity. We have been looking at cash for a long time, trying to understand the very best way to get cash to people and what's most effective. And there are kind of, my mind did go right to, how does this fit into this kind of wider basket of saving or giving options that families have? The child tax credit, for folks tuning in, has been around and has different forms at the state and federal level, but had this massive expansion during the pandemic, a one-year expansion with really dramatic results, basically dropped child poverty in half. And then it bounced right back once we stopped giving that. It was only funded for a year, so it wasn't a permanent program. That's more in the territory of give people money now. They can spend it now related to, you know, their family size. We'll mention a couple times today this RX Kids program that we have in Michigan, which is more on the baby bonus spectrum, where we're giving cash up front and then a little bit of a monthly stipend for the first year of the baby's life, investing early on. And then there's this whole range of baby bonds, which have, you know, let's build kind of a wealth purpose toward the end. And so when I saw the Dell announcement, it's clearly in that bonds, baby bond territory. This will be available later. I saw a bunch of people doing back of envelope math. How much will this be worth, you know, in 18 years? And who's left out for it? There's a lot of questions in the details of how it works, I'm sure we'll get into. I also thought, as a giver, as someone who might have money to share, like, what's attractive to me about these accounts or as a giving form? There's lots of options to give, kind of tax advantage giving. A 529 account where you can save for education is in some ways sort of like a baby bond. If the Trump accounts or where the Dell gift is going is only available for certain purposes at the end of that road, there's sort of the lapse and the growth, but also what can you use it on? And so that's something I wanted to kind of unpack a little bit too. We have this commitment to unconditional, unrestricted cash that we right. think is where the evidence is. But those are some of my quick thoughts.
Yeah. So for folks who are only listening and not watching, when Dustin was talking about, you know, the growth of this and the back of the envelope, Leah was like, it's, you know, kind of mouthed that it's a small amount. And so let's talk about that just briefly, right? So I think some of those back of envelope measures show that the $250, even if you assume, right, a 10% growth rate over 18 years and that nothing bad happens to it, you're only really looking at like $1,100 when that, you know, kid turns 18. So not really a monumental sum, especially in the broader picture of, you know, this $6.25 billion. Like, you know, I think the three of us on this call are excited about most direct cash programs and can see the impact of it. But also, as people who love data and think a lot about econ, we also talk a lot about opportunity cost, right? And so, Leah, maybe you can talk a bit about this $6.25 billion, right? That $1,000, you know, $1,100 over 18 years. Like, when you saw that, you're like, maybe we could have deployed that money in other ways. And then, you know, Dustin, I'll come back to you to talk a little bit about, like, RX Kids and how we can think about, you know, deploying money really effectively.
Yeah, I think baby bonds have kind of a false economy associated with them, which is that you don't have to put in very much money at the beginning to get out more money at the end through the magic of compound interest. And I'm a big fan of compound interest, obviously.
The eighth watch of the world, as Einstein said.
Yeah, but, you know, as you said, this is coming out to about $1,000, $1,100 in optimistic economic conditions when kids are 18. And I think if you had announced this as a program where you were giving kids $1,000 when they turn 18 without the magic of baby bonds with a higher price tag, it would be pretty obvious then this is not life-changing money for those kids. Yeah, this is going to get absorbed pretty quickly into college costs, etc. Will it help? Sure. Is this a very effective bang for the buck for spending billions of dollars? No, probably not. That's one reason why I favor baby bonuses right after birth, because you are automatically concentrating that money when you know there's more need for it. You know, you can talk a bit about, do I want to spend upfront or on the back end the same amount of money, the compound interest? But I think one thing that leaves out is you are almost guaranteed the parents need the money more at birth than they do when their kids are 18.
Right.
And that's not just because they have the income shock in that first year of life, about 10% of their income. It's because definitionally the parents are younger. And younger parents means less savings on hand, earlier in their career, smaller wage premium. So kind of letting that compound interest idea eclipse the fact that the value of the marginal dollar is a lot higher for parents of a newborn than it is for parents of an 18-year-old, I think really distorts the idea of how much good is this doing for parents on the margin and how many parents are on the margin at either time point.
So then why do you think they have like created these setups where you aren't able to, you know, like withdraw some of this money earlier? Like, I think a lot of people are comparing it to, you know, IRAs and 401k accounts and some of these types of things. Like, what's the purpose of, you know, putting those shackles on this, for lack of a better word?
I think for one thing, it does cut against a little bit of the idea of being a pro-family program that trusts families to make good choices if you're locking up the money. But I think a big part of it is it lets you distort the impact a little bit, that you're getting a lot of the credit for the compound interest. When parents are free to take a baby bonus and sink it into the stock market, if they want to, and if that's the best use of their money. But I don't count a $2,000 baby bonus as secretly being worth whatever it would be if you invested in it, because I expect that's not how many parents will choose to use the money, or that it would be the best choice for them.
So,
you know, I price out a baby bonus of $2,000 per kid at somewhere between $5.5 to $7 billion a year. You know, that's almost on par with this donation, but I'm upfront, you know, it's more per family to get an impact, and it's coming when they need it most. Kind of undercounting the cost and then overcrediting the impact is, I think, a big feature of baby bonds.
Right. You're like, if I didn't buy these diapers and I instead invested this money, like, would my kid be able to go to a different college? But you're like, I need these diapers now. I don't have that opportunity to make that trade-off. Dustin, you have spent a lot of time developing these types of programs, figuring out when to give money. RX Kids is fantastic. It is such a powerful program, you know, that ran, you know, in Flint, Michigan, really focused on this very specific, you know, group of new mothers, had all these, you know, very, you know, useful measures and community partners that you all worked with. Talk about like how you have decided, you know, and some of these ones, what you all have learned in that process and where you think some of those benefits have kind of accrued.
Yeah, definitely. And Leah, I was just laughing about your point in my mind. I'm like, you've said it better than I could, but that inversion of counting the future dollars sort of as present value, I think, is this trick that we think about in baby bonds. You will build wealth, you will build compound interest, you'll be better off with that money in the future, but it's just the kind of inversion of the dollars today, right? Turning $200 into $1,000 or whatever it turns out to be. So I totally agree with you on that. With RX Kids, again, it's $1,500 in the prenatal period, so to the mother when she's pregnant, and then $500 a month for 12. And in some cases, we do a shorter six-month program. We're in over 20 communities in Michigan, and it's expanding really dramatically with state funds. Next year, it'll ramp up to about 1 in 3 babies in Michigan will start receiving this.
Wow.
So it's incredible, and it's kind of the reason it's expanding is based on the evidence. So lots of research out there on it, but just to highlight a couple pieces, really dramatically better financial wellness, especially around housing, big drops in evictions. For the mother's health, mental health is a lot better. Mothers actually smoke less in the third trimester, like less stress probably, and then that's driving much better outcomes for the babies. So there's almost a 30% drop in NICU admissions for babies who are receiving this program versus a comparable group.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I think Dr. Mona, one of the champions of the program, one of the visionaries who started, a pediatrician in Flint, Michigan, which has the highest child poverty rate in the country for a city of that size, has made the point of like public health departments spend billions of dollars locally just to move the needle on some of these outcomes, and getting cash to moms at this really critical period in the right dosage, to use a clinical term, the right amount of cash, unlocks a lot of potential there. The other point I'll add, I will try to keep my like implementer hat on. I go down the policy route. I love that angle, but we actually run a different program in Georgia where low-income women could pick whether they wanted a monthly payment or to get a portion of that as a lump sum. So it was either $1,000 a month for 3 years or a lump sum of $8,000. And I'm curious for you both, what percentage do you think opted into the lump sum? It's the same amount of money in the long run, and people could pick. And they could also pick when they want to receive it. But for your first question, what percent do you think went with the lump sum or the steady monthly amount?
I predict 70% steady monthly amount.
Yeah, I would have said 60 steady and 40 lump sum.
It's 2/3. So y'all are spot on. Great intuition.
High five.
And then almost everyone who picked a lump sum want the very first window to draw it down. So I think like, low-income people have really sophisticated financial lives. They're doing a lot with their money, and it's different with cash. That's what we like about cash. And they're telling us in their actions that more money up front is what they would prefer. And maybe that's because they want to invest it early. I mean, we don't know. We have ongoing research there. But I think this kind of earlier, the marginal value earlier on, I agree with Leah on that.
Yeah. And this point, you know, is definitely worth emphasizing about like just the value of these cash programs. And I think politically, you know, why it's also started to like, you know, gain momentum in many circles is because of that, you know, flexibility, right? Where it's like, we don't know necessarily if you need this for housing, for education, for healthcare, for food, for, you know, getting new school supplies for your kids. And that flexibility, you know, that cash offers is unparalleled, right? You know, housing voucher programs are amazing, right? SNAP is amazing, but the ability to, you know, adapt to those needs is so important. And I imagine for many of those people, and research continues to show this, like use that for some of these very large payments that could be really, you know, detrimental to their lives and send it in a different direction. A giant unexpected medical bill, you know, a car accident that, you know, prevents you from being able to get to work that could, you know, result in, you know, unemployment, which could, you know, follow for, you know, into homelessness. And so that ability to have that flexibility, you know, can be quite nice.
And I think it's worth noting that one of the big benefits that parents get from cash around the time of birth is it frees moms to take FMLA leave that they've earned. But because FMLA leave is unpaid, it's guaranteed job protection, but unpaid leave, many families can't afford to take it. So you've earned it, you're entitled to it, you don't have the cash to sustain it. And this is one of the things where an infusion of cash right after birth allows people to use the benefits they've earned but otherwise couldn't afford.
Yeah, Leah, we're going to have to disagree on a future question because I was going to make a similar point, which is we really see cash as a complement to the other safety net programs. The U.S. safety net is incredibly fragmented. It's uncertain. It's hard to access. And this bit of cash to complement people and what they might be able to receive, like FMLA, I wasn't thinking of that example. It's a great one. But if you can't get to your WIC appointment or you can't get to your prenatal appointment or can't, you know, stop work a little bit early, then you're not getting the full value of those benefits that we're already sending and supporting families with.
On this point of flexibility, and Leah, you had alluded to a little bit earlier, which is that there is a myth in, you know, direct cash programs that people are spending this money on alcohol, on cigarettes, right, on anything that, you know, the illicit things that they, you know, maybe want to do, which the research consistently shows is not true. But let's talk a bit about this, like, political environment, right? This Dell $6.25 billion is only possible, really, because of these, you know, new Trump accounts that he has created with the Treasury, right, where, you know, children will be getting $1,000 into those accounts. What is making this, like, administration, you know, and Leah, maybe I'll start off with you, like, you know, interested in, you know, cash in some of these programs where maybe we would have expected that, you know, them to be pushing that myth narrative a little bit more, and now we're actually not seeing that.
Well, I think it's good to note there's been an expanded appetite for family benefits in this Congress and this administration period. So I would put this in the larger landscape of what we also saw during reconciliation, where we saw a Republican trifecta both plus up the CTC, raising it from 2,000 to 2,200, but for the first time, indexing the child tax credit to inflation, which has been a long-term goal, you know, without achieving that, without that, families see their child tax credit cut every year in real value. So I think it's good that you're seeing some kind of new right pressure to expand what we do for families. And then you get into the question of means. And baby bonds really started as a Democratic-led idea, you know, giving a nest egg to underprivileged kids. It's been kind of adopted on the right as an anti-socialism, pro-free market move, again, with the idea that steering benefits to families away from just cash in hand and towards exposure to the stock market will change people's attitudes about the stock market. And what I find perplexing about that as a theory of change is that all of these programs steer that money towards low-cost index funds, which is where I would tell parents to put it. But I have low-cost index funds. It doesn't lead me to think, I own a piece of McDonald's, I own a piece of NVIDIA, even though I do. I don't see the names of anything bundled into my low index fund. I just see an incomprehensible combination of five letters. So I think if you want kids to really understand the powers of compound interest, the powers of the American stock market, the powers of free trade, you need to explain that more explicitly than just parking this money in an index fund.
Dustin, your thoughts on like why this administration seems excited about these programs now?
Yeah, I mean, give an example from Michigan. There's a divided house there now, and they expanded RX Kids funds. I don't want to oversell every sitting elected member in Michigan loves RX Kids, but it's popular, and there are sitting conservative champions who are writing op-eds, going on interviews, and saying, you know, this is the pro-family thing. This is the way to support people for various reasons. There's a think tank there that has an article that's like, Milton Friedman would love RX Kids, you know, like, cash sometimes has some strange bedfellows. On the Dell announcement in particular, we raise lots of money to get to low-income people around the world at GiveDirectly. Donors are idiosyncratic. I don't know the Dells. I'm super excited about this gift. Sometimes it's easier to give to something new than old. You could seed 529 accounts for a long time, and lots of donors do that, and that's wonderful. This, like I said, to me feels a little bit similar if the conditions, we don't really know yet, but if it's only for education or a down payment or something like that. But the Dells get to make this incredible splash and focus effort on giving, and like it's a big success. And now there is this vehicle to do so through the Trump administration. So that it could be as simple as some of the donor personal calculus.
Yeah. And I think, you know, even just on this, like, it's worth remembering that Reagan was a very big proponent of like the EITC and CTC and sort of like help expand those things. And yeah, I think some of this, you know, and I saw some person, you know, in the chat mention like, you know, Biden bucks were popular. Like everyone was excited when they got their, you know, checks in the mail. Like it could also just be political calculus. You know, I think Dustin, as you're saying too, like there's just something fresh in the air. And as, you know, folks are thinking about their approval numbers and what they want to do, like cash is fun. Getting a check in the mail feels good. Like when you're a new parent too, and things can feel stressful and daunting, that part can also just be exciting.
But the political payoff here is a lot weaker. You know, you don't get the check in the mail here. You do get access to an account you could track. But the Trump accounts themselves with the $1,000 seed money, that's a 4-year temporary pilot that's scheduled to expire by default. And at the time it's on the cusp of expiring and Congress is thinking about what do we want to use this pay for, there won't be a single kid who's reaped the benefit of the money who you can bring out as a success story. There won't be any of those for 16 years.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good point. And you won't get that news moment of someone who gets to like show up their Biden check. Like I was with, you know, teaching in a class last week and the teacher had their, you know, check like, you know, thumbtacked to the wall, which was fun to see. And I was like, I hope she's cashed this already. Like fun, you know, desk souvenir too. But I think like so many of these types of things, exactly as you're pointing out, once you pull back, you know, the curtain on this and start, you know, looking underneath the hood at what these programs are actually doing, implementing, how the, you know, communities are going to benefit from it, you're like, you start squinting a little bit, you know, about why did they make some of those certain policy choices. On that front, this is a universal program, right? You know, some of it is tied to zip codes, you know, and the income thresholds at those. There has also been questions raised about, like, why did they decide to, you know, make it as expansive as it is? Could it have been more targeted to lower income families, you know, to, you know, certain states or demographics or things like that? Leah, I saw you shaking your head a little bit about, you know, even the universality of it. So maybe you can start talking about, you know, how you think that choice came to be and whether or not there were other considerations that were perhaps missed.
So it's means tested in a kind of wacky way that this is $250 for kids born in the last 10 years, which probably includes my kids. So I'm trying to verify this. So I've got some investment here, depending on the average income of your zip code. And at an implementation detail, I don't know yet whether that means the zip code in which I was resident when each of my three kids were born, the zip code in which I'm resident right now when I'll be enrolling in the program, I think this coming summer is the plan, the zip code of the hospitals in which my kids were delivered, regardless of whether I was resident in that zip code. It's a little confusing. And obviously, it will kind of provoke some fun Ember papers in the long term about kids who are just on the margin of whatever zip code or near the cutoffs. But, you know, I'm enough of a policy wonk to understand. I think a lot of this was about having some number they were willing to put on the line and then dealing with all the dials of how many kids are included or excluded, how much do you need to put in for it to sound meaningful as a number, 250 versus 200 versus 500? And where do you strike the balance between all of those? I don't think there's a strong policy consideration behind exactly why these zip codes, why this cutoff.
Yeah, no, I mean, when this was announced, I immediately went to the website. I like started looking up what my, you know, the zip code, right where I currently live, the zip code where my, you know, son was born, those different things. Like, and really there's not a lot of information on that site. Like you can add your email address into some fields. You don't even get a confirmation email that your email address got added to, you know, some like wait list or whatever it is. But yeah, Dustin, as you have, you know, again, worked on implementing some of these programs and had to make some of those hard, you know, trade-offs of like, we are going to include or exclude this. We decide that after this many months, you are no longer eligible. Were there certain things that you think like were missed in the rollout of this program? Like, I think there's also a lot to be said for simplicity too, as I think Leo was alluding to. Like, were there parts like, again, it's an exciting program, but you're like, maybe I would have done it in a different way.
Yeah, I think any time you're stepping down from a truly universal program, which is pretty rare in the scheme of things because we all have opinions. We used to work at Code for America and we had this great graphic where someone said, we do SNAP to feed people. Then it's like, well, low-income people. And then it's like, well, who may break. And then all of a sudden you're in this like long scroll that's like rolling across the office of who we're trying to target. But I mean, broadly, it's an extraordinary amount of money and it's going to reach a lot of people. I think the zip code is a tricky thing, but it's not totally unusual. We were all talking about opportunity zones for a really long time recently. And one of our amazing researchers on RX Kids, the co-director Luke, has a book about, you know, the poverty of place. Like this is a well-known thing that where you live can really drive some of the outcomes. And then I want to give grace. I think there's just some TBD things, and that is often any new thing is not ready at the start. I'm super curious about the opt-in versus opt-out. There are Nobel Prizes awarded on this question around 401ks and others of like, do you get it as a default or do you have to go and sign up and claim it? And that can be really dramatic. I think some of the articles have gone into the depths on this on research.
And right, it's opt-in right now, correct?
That's my understanding.
But I think we'll know more in 5 months than we do now about what exactly that will look like and how much chasing down there will be of people to opt-in.
Yeah.
Or whether kids will be able to opt in later, like will it be held in trust for them if their parents aren't on the ball? Can the kids claim it at some other point?
Got it.
Yeah. And I'm curious too, like Leah talked about earlier, what are these invested in? Is it like a 529? There's a marketplace of funds, or you can get riskier, but there's a lot of nudging away, or is it preceded in crypto? Like I don't know what's on the table.
That's really what I think. We're all thinking. Yeah.
4 years to do something with it. There's a lot to figure out, but you're right. I mean, the art is in implementation. That's been a big lesson of my career. And I think, you know, I think smart people are thinking about this and hopefully bears out to make it as easy as possible as a default and as inclusive as possible. Just a quick side note, and RX Kids is universal in the communities it's in. And this creates some challenges and inequities, of course, for people who live just outside of those. But I really think some of the outcomes of their program are because of the universal nature. And I think some of the political success is because of the universal nature. We're avoiding the stigma of certain populations that have been, you know, cast down in the American welfare state conversation for decades or even longer. By just saying this is something we do to support our community. It's a program of love. And I think the more you go that route, you can keep the tent pretty big.
Yeah. And I think there's also a lot to be said, you know, just for simplicity of implementation and the cost savings that can come from this, right? Like no program implementation is free. You need to hire staff, people who can do this work. And, you know, a concept I think a lot about is like the leaky bucket, right? You have this big, you know, bucket of cash that you were trying to deliver to someone, and you maybe poke many, many more holes in it by creating all of these other hoops that people need to jump through, analyses that, you know, you need your staff to do, you know, pathways for them to actually access these things. You know, they have these new treasury accounts that will make this accessible, right? What are the types of accounts and how often they'll be able to like check them and withdraw from them. And so their ability to like reduce the number of holes in that, you know, possibly very leaky bucket, you know, says a lot. On the American Inequality Substack, like we often ask like people to put, you know, questions, you know, in sort of ahead of some of these Substack lives. And one, you know, person kind of asked this question of like, you know, does having more money in your pockets today make you less likely to kind of require asking for more money in the future or being more reliant, you know, on other social services? Dustin, I know you said like you think about cash as basically being like, you know, complementary to many of these other programs. But I'm curious if either one of you like have seen that proven out, know anything about this of like, you know, if we can kind of give you this, you know, foundation early, it makes it, you know, cheaper, you know, for governments, for communities, you know, further on down the road, whether that's like less likely to be relying on other social services or even like lower rates of incarceration, high school dropout, things like that.
Yeah. Thanks, Leah. I think there's a lot of literature out there, especially for these early childhood investments around outcomes down the road. Similarly with Medicaid access, with SNAP papers, I think Hillary Hoynes done really good work on this. And my sense of the broad literature is, yes, and you know, an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of treatment down the road. That kind of aspect works in a lot of this. I would say that cash in general is a little bit newer. A lot of the dynamic programs that we've done in cash sort of started around 2020, maybe a little bit before. It's an old concept, but I think the longitudinal piece of the puzzle isn't as clear to me where I sit right now. I'm optimistic about it. And then I think also at the same time, sometimes cash is its own worst enemy to study precisely because people can spend it on anything. And our whole kind of literature of how we evaluate programs is at best an RCT, the average treatment effect. But if you're giving it to broadly a population, the beauty is the flexibility, but it means you might not see strong health outcomes on this thing because 100 people out of the 1,000 worked on health with their cash and then another 100 did education. And it all kind of washes out. So there's some methodological challenges for like the very long run outputs of cash, but I'm as optimistic about it as I am other things we do, right? Like we're already seeing these health outcomes. If your baby's going through the NICU and what are their outcomes a year, two, 5 years later, third grade reading scores, whatever, there's a theory of change here that I think is pretty sound.
Right.
Yeah, I would say that there are some pretty well put together studies that find what are still facially surprising long-term results. I think there's one where you get increased cash. I think through the EITC was the mechanism in childhood. And then these kids' earnings as adults are slightly higher. Is that possible? Maybe. I don't pitch EITC reform on that basis, though, both because even when the studies seem to hold up, it's pretty attenuated effects. It's harder for me to genuinely pitch a politician. I'm confident this is going to hold up over different years or different economic conditions. I do like studies like the RX Kids where I can say, okay, when moms have this cash in hand, when they can prioritize their health and their baby's health, NICU admissions go down, premature birth goes down. Do I expect that has long-term effects? Of course, but I don't expect to have really great measures of them in the long term. But that near-term payoff is itself enough to make the case for me.
Yeah, because I also think it's, you know, interesting just even on this question of how do we measure the impact of some of these things. I think one, you know, is this point that like children probably aren't going to meaningfully change their lives because they're like, oh, score, I have $250 like in this account. Like I'm free from all of these different things. Like I don't know how much of a, you know, like mental or behavioral impact it's kind of going to have on that perspective. But I think two, right, over the last, you know, 2 to 4 years, there have been some studies that have really, you know, tried to show the gaps that direct cash giving, you know, have done, you know, some from, you know, OpenAI's, you know, research, another one that, you know, Jason DePaul in the New York Times wrote like a very, you know, significant piece on. But I think some of the pushback, you know, as I continue to talk to people in, you know, the cash space, economic space, policy space, was like some of those were looking at measures that don't really matter that much to parents or are missing the mark, right? Like, you know, questions like, did your, you know, stress decrease, you know, as a result of being a new mother and getting this cash injection? And, you know, Dustin, I know you talked a little bit about this, but like, as both, you know, parents, you know, with, you know, kids under two, like stress kind of just becomes part of the baseline now for you, right? And so asking this question of that, it's like, you know, are you really connecting very closely with your community? Like, are you measuring the same types of things that, you know, they care a lot about? And so as we see this new cash injection, are we going to be asking those right types of questions to show the efficacy of it, you know, 5, 10, 20 years down the road?
And I also want to say there are things I care a lot about that I think cash aid to parents can enable, where frankly, I don't care if it comes up in some of these outcomes. You know, if being able to take FMLA leave means a mom can sustain breastfeeding and establish a good rhythm with her child, I care a lot about that purely for her and her baby, regardless of whether it increases that kid's prospective earnings or disciplinary record or anything else. There are some goods that come from supporting parents' investment in their kids that are good in and of themselves without any downstream effects.
I was going to say, just on this kind of outcomes topic, a bit of consensus within our panel of like, we really like the baby bonds and the early intervention, sorry, the baby bonuses and the early intervention. Leah just leaves the chat.
I think there's something wrong with yourself. Huh?
Yeah. But on the baby bond side, to be fair, that the opportunity for more research on the effects, like we are driven by evidence, we're open to that. Just to mention, we have a program running right now in the Bronx that was conceived of before we knew about the Dell gift, but it's young adults and they receive 18 to 30 and they receive six payments. One is a month, five of the six are monthly. And then the third one is a lump sum of $8,000. So maybe if you think of a Trump account of 1,000 growing for a while and a little extra, and it's almost like a simulation of the end point of these programs. And it's not conditional. So people don't have to spend it on education or a house or whatever. But I think there's a bunch of research. We're hopeful for that program to speak to, like, we don't have to wait 18 years to understand how some of these dynamics might work. That's live right now. We'll share plenty of research. There's also an org in Atlanta that we partner a lot with, Grow, who have just launched a similar idea where it's like, it's a baby bonds program, but it's for young adults and they're getting a lump sum that's sort of like the equivalent of that growth. But let's fast forward and see what people do with it. So there's a lot to learn on this.
Dustin, as someone who spends time like, you know, fundraising and, you know, working with a lot of these like, you know, very wealthy folks who can, you know, kind of support some of these like impactful programs, is there anything that is, I don't know, like, interesting or noteworthy to you about like just a single family running one of these absolutely massive like through government programs? Anything that's interesting about it like happening now, or this is something that occurs, it is like a net positive, or this is one of those things where we are now seeing like the private sector maybe taking on a role that we would like the public sector to actually be doing?
Yeah. I mean, I think the Dell gift in particular is extraordinary and large and pretty unique in the wider landscape. This might just be my bias coming from the civic tech world, the Code for America background, but it's like, if you really want to operate at scale, the government has to be part of the picture. And when I talk to donors and philanthropists and private givers, it's sort of like, can you be a risk taker to try ideas? And they're pushing us on like, how does this roll up and sustain it to a sustainable thing? I don't want to fund something for forever. I want to see where this can grow. And that usually means getting anchored into a government program. So Arx Kids is that dynamics playing out there. An original local foundation, a community foundation, made a challenge grant to start. And then we brought in some government funds and different pots, and then the big state expansion. I think that's like the dream of everything flowing together in a good way. I did see some, you know, snarky stuff online of like, we always say, you know, if you're wealthy, you could just donate more of your money in taxes to the government. And that's kind of what the Dells are doing, right? They're putting the money into, in a way. And so I don't agree with the snark, but I think I like when programs are building into government versus setting up a parallel system. I think we learn private side, but then to scale, I live in San Francisco, our city budget is $16 billion that they're going to spend 2.5 delegifts this year and next year, So like you can't ignore that if you want to have some wide systems change.
Yeah, I'd say that I work in public policy. You work in philanthropy that can guide it. And one of the big gifts I get from things like GiveDirectly's pilot programs is it helps me answer questions that politicians and voters urgently have that rarely get answered when you actually try launching the program at the governmental level first. You know, we do not pass programs with a like structured pilot phase and with an RCT so we can check whether they work. We'll do these pilot times without a way of gathering data in the most helpful way. And one question the RX Kids rollout has really helped clarify that's been a big concern for some of these cash to family programs is a social conservative concern, which is this repeating certain patterns that worried people about older welfare programs? Does giving moms in particular cash in hand wind up competing with what a husband can offer? So that once you have this government source of funds, are you subtly militating against marriage? And you know, this has prompted questions for baby bonus of should it be conditioned on marriage? Should there be a bonus for families that are married at the time of birth? I'm against this partly just because I think it doesn't do what you want. I don't think anyone who has a good guy that's kind of on the cusp of marrying you values that at more than, or sorry, values that at less than the $2,000 extra you would get. You know, marriage is itself kind of self-recommending in that way. But what was really helpful about the RX Kids, because it's, you know, got this phase in, they were able to find that making cash available around the time of birth increased the odds of moms marrying the husbands, the fathers of their kids, which I think wasn't clear that people anticipated that. And the exact mechanism of how that happens is a little unclear. I'd love you guys to do more ethnographic studies alongside this. But the theory is that lowering stress in that first year makes it easier for men and women to figure out how they're navigating this new relationship and ultimately say, we're up to do this for the rest of our lives. But it's one of the number one questions I get about family benefits. Are we giving out money in a way that's ultimately destructive to family formation? And smaller scale RCTs help me figure that out.
I can't believe we haven't mentioned TANF in this call. America has a national cash program, temporary assistance for needy families. I would call it dumpster fire in a lot of ways, but one of the program goals is strengthening the two family kind of, or two parent households. It's an kind of explicit goal. And the other is, you know, supporting low-income people. And there's a million things we can do, but RX Kids is braiding in TANF dollars and showing there's a different way to use this money that's really effective that can still achieve those goals.
I see there are a few questions coming in through the chat, so I wanted to, you know, kind of call some of those out. You know, Dustin, maybe you can respond to, you know, this one about like, do we think that this is going to kind of create a, you know, behavioral change, right, for children going into adulthood or for families, right? I think there is maybe something to be said about like, we are actually entering this new era, right, where we have been talking about these types of programs for a long time. And all of a sudden, we are actually about to have 25 million children who grow up in this new world. Like, are we about to see some new generation that like thinks about the stock market, their relationship with the government, like their love of Dell computers, like in a totally new way? Like, are we moving to this future?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's probably an I don't know for me. Like, I'm happy to speculate a bit. I try to think, I put myself in those shoes. I was going to college as a first-gen college student and like got a great scholarship, had a lot of resources, amazingly supportive family. But like that chunk of money, even if we're on the lower end, was really meaningful to me to like stretch through the summer or something like that and doing, you know, work study jobs and things. So I do think it's a real asset, and it's the young people will tell us what they do with it. And I don't want to presume what it is, but I think it could be. I'm sure there's just as many who aren't aware of it, and it feels distant and abstract until the account keys are handed over to them. You know, I'm not sure.
Right.
I'm pretty bearish on this, you know, in part because a large chunk of the Dell stuff is historical, so it can't affect parents' decision to have a child when it's in the past. The prospective stuff is piloted and sunsetting. And again, it's that you have a note that says you have money in the future. And I think that's hard for that to change people's decisions in the near term and hard for kids to plan around in a big way. You know, I think it's important to remember that kind of fragility in any government program erodes confidence in all government programs. So in the same way you see kids assuming they won't get Social Security, which isn't really what we anticipate, even in the most severe scenarios, we might anticipate a cut, but not none. I think it's harder to trust that money you've seen no one else collect is really going to be there for you when you plan on it.
Mm, that's very interesting. Yeah, it's, you know, one of these interesting things too, where you just forget about it. And I don't know, I wonder, we had your earlier point about like the political points that you can even gain from this. Like, yeah, I remember at my bar mitzvah, like you get one of these, you know, bonds from your like weird uncle that you're grateful for at the time. But then, yeah, you forget about it until like at some point you get another letter in the mail and you're like, who gave that to me again? And you're like, what? Who was that president back then? And so, yeah, I'm not, you know, again, not fully sure how much of a behavioral impact this will have on our communities, especially given that the, you know, total lump sum that they'll see, you know, down the road is probably close to, you know, $1,100. I want to end with a question that we always end with at American Inequality, which is around the path forward, right? You know, many of these issues around, you know, inequality can feel really overwhelming. We have covered, you know, so much ground talking around, you know, the challenges that, you know, young mothers face around, you know, healthcare, you know, food, right? We covered such a huge range of programs, and the web of that can feel really interconnected, and that can also make it feel really hard to address. When we're thinking about direct, you know, cash programs, the impact that we want to, you know, make for, you know, some of these low-income families in particular, whether it's through sweeping, you know, public sector programs, through nonprofits, through work that individuals can do, what do you all see as, you know, some of these like powerful forces, you know, either in, you know, of those, you know, three areas, you know, public, private, you know, individual or nonprofit work that can be done, so that way people can continue to address some of the issues that we've brought up on this call. Dustin, you want to go first?
Sure, I'll go first. It's a good question. It depends a little bit on your personality in some ways. I think we joke about like, how can we make the safety net cashier? Like that, I think that would be a good direction to go in. And a lot of our programs, I won't give another Arts Kids example, but to take a different one, we're looking a lot at homelessness and housing. We're going to start a project with the state of California next year around seniors and housing, the fastest growing group of homeless individuals, and really explicitly comparing cash to the voucher programs that we have that are kind of the bedrock of how we support people on the housing like access, and just trying to prove out, do people lease up faster? What's the quality of housing they get? What happens when it's time to renew? I don't know if cash is better or not. Like, we have some theories, but like, we want to be that lab with really rigorous third-party evaluators to show the leverage points within the safety net we do have. Because I think there was a lot of dynamic legislation during the pandemic, and then we'll see, but things might be frozen again. And we need that, those changes at the margin is where my mind tends to go. But I'm totally happy to horse trade and like get rid of TANF and fund Leah's baby bonus program. We could fund it two times over based, I think, on your back of the envelope math. Like, those bold ideas are awesome too. And sometimes things squeak through, you know, the policy window. So
when you say make things cashier, can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, are you talking about getting rid of, you know, some of the like hurdles or vouchers or kind of like, you know, dedicated spending, you know, paths that we put people on?
Yeah, just really putting dignity back in the hands of people to make their own spending decisions with predictability. So even our programs, you know, they work one way on paper, but if you talk to someone who's ever received food stamps or something, it comes and goes for completely inscrutable reasons. Same with Medicaid. States do these different background wage checks or things like that. A consistent support, and then being able to use it on whatever you want to use it on. Even food stamps, you know, you can't buy in most places hot food in the deli. You have to only buy the non-prepared food. Like, I get where that's coming from, but the evidence is telling us that doesn't work. And so across all these dimensions, vouchers, SNAP, TANF, like, how can we kind of get back to that flexibility that we know is the best outcome for people?
Yeah. And I think that flexibility, exactly as you said, comes with dignity too. And being able to, you know, instill that in so many of these programs is, again, one of these measures that is really hard to account for, but so central to U.S. public policy.
And I'd say for this big picture question, one thing to keep in mind is I'm approaching this whole policy area from a slightly different point of view than Dustin. You know, I'm working family benefits not just with an eye to reducing inequality, but just strengthening family formation. So when I look at the impact of a program, I'm not looking primarily at the Gini index. I'm looking at things like the gap between the number of kids people say they want to have and the number they're actually having, which in the U.S. is about like half a kid to one kid per woman. So part of the measure of these benefits, how we judge where is it helpful to intervene, I think mostly about lowering the opportunity cost to having a child. And that opportunity cost is driven in some degrees by our prosperity. You know, because parents can command a higher wage, it's harder to take a step back from work or a disruption to work to have a kid. The cost goes up because of people demanding higher wages. The Baumol effect means that childcare will keep running away much higher in cost inflation than goods will. Yeah. So when you look at that landscape, you know, you're kind of saying, well, where can I blunt this opportunity cost? I can't make it go away, but maybe I can reduce the rate at which it's growing or make it a little easier right at the start. Cash in hand obviously blunts that in a very direct way. But I think the other lens to look at, which isn't the focus of our conversation here, is you can better that opportunity cost balance by increasing how pleasant it is to be a parent. And there you get into things like flex work, you know, whether children are welcome, you know, in your community, whether your zoning and your streets are all designed to make it easy to be out and about with your kid rather than isolated in your home, whether it's easy to move to the kind of house that serves you well as your family grows. So, you know, that's also a domain where there's a lot of room for both local work, national work, private philanthropy to say, where is there unnecessary friction that comes with being a parent or having one more kid? And how can we ease that friction a little bit?
Yeah, I think that is so well put, Leah. And I think, you know, even more broadly, both of you are touching on this idea of like, how can we help people better go from what their, you know, wants are to achieving, you know, those wants, right? You have this gap of saying like, I want to have this many kids. I want to, you know, put this much food on the table. I want to be able to, you know, provide this much for my family. And right now there is this huge gap between those things. And there are so many different barriers that can cause that. But cash offers that, you know, flexibility for people to very much so narrow that gap. And I think so many of these questions in the U.S. between inequality and opportunity are like, how far are people away from achieving those dreams? What can we do to give them those, you know, foundations and those tools to basically get closer to that? And I think right now, you know, we are living in this really important time where we are trying to help people get closer to that in an age where it's so often felt like they are, you know, moving further away from that, particularly for so many of these marginalized communities. And so it was exciting to see, you know, one of these, you know, programs grow. And it's very exciting to have you both on to, you know, talk about the ways that you have both, you know, seen that occur in communities and done it in your work. So, Leah, thank you, you know, so much for coming on. Dustin as well. Everyone should make sure to go check out Leah's Substack as well and the RX Kids from Dustin and GiveDirectly. And thanks so much for joining today.
Thank you.
Bye, both.